Greetings, everyone. This is Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us today, and very best wishes in this time of amazing political change and turmoil in Pakistan, also a holiday season. Our best wishes to friends around the world, but especially in Pakistan. I'm privileged to moderate this discussion today, featuring my esteemed colleague, Madia Afzal, a David Rubenstein Fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, as well as a renowned and esteemed columnist for the newspaper Dawn, Fahd Hussein. And we are here, of course, as you know, to discuss the political moment in Pakistan, which, depending on your perspective, could be viewed as a moment of impressive implementation and impressive checks and balances across the different major institutions in Pakistan's government, the parliament, the prime minister, and of course the Supreme Court. Or it could also be viewed as a moment of peril and political crisis that implicates not only Pakistan's future, but even its relationships with other countries, including the United States, at a time when the prime minister has accused his country's opposition of being somehow in cahoots with Washington against him. The Pakistani military has certainly been following this closely, but has been staying out of any direct intervention, which, of course, for longstanding students of Pakistan's politics and for Pakistanis is a very important development so far. And we're here to discuss all of this today. So, Madia, I've just framed things as I see them as a generalist, but I wonder if I could begin by asking you to frame things. And, you know, I guess to put a question to you directly, I'm curious as to see whether you see this largely as a moment of potential opportunity for Pakistan or as a very dangerous moment, or maybe both. So over to you, my friend.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to Brookings for hosting this space today. Well, Pakistan has just come off a very troubling week, a week full of political uncertainty when there was really a political vacuum. The government said that the National Assembly had been dissolved, but it was unclear whether that was constitutional, and the Supreme Court heard the case for 4 days. And it ended with yesterday with what is not a given in Pakistan, good news. Its constitution prevailing in a landmark historic judgment by the Supreme Court. So I'll just rewind quickly. For those who may not be familiar, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan was set to face a vote of no confidence that had been brought against him. The motion had been brought against him on March 8th, but he was set to face that vote of no confidence on April 3rd, this past Sunday, you know, sort of at the culmination of a political crisis that had been going on for weeks and lots of political maneuvering and behind the scenes deals going on, and we can talk about those. And Khan was set to lose that vote of no confidence because of two key coalition allies that had moved over to the opposition parties. And the other, the opposition was expected to then form government with Shehbaz Sharif as their united candidate for prime minister. Khan, at that point, pulled, and his government pulled a surprise and an unconstitutional move by having the Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly throw out the no confidence vote on Sunday. After doing that, the President, Arif Alvi, dissolved the National Assembly on Khan's advice and said that new elections will be called in 90 days. So this is what was before the Supreme Court on went before the Supreme Court on Sunday, and the Supreme Court took 4 days and came out with a clear, unequivocal judgment, basically righting the wrongs of April 3rd, saying the Deputy Speaker's ruling was unconstitutional, it had no legal effect, it would be set aside, the National Assembly was restored. In fact, it had existed at all times in the previous week. So there really should not have been a political vacuum, and that Khan is now set to face a vote of no confidence tomorrow. And this is despite the Supreme Court having a checkered history. You know, it has rubber-stamped coups in Pakistan's history, military coups, through the doctrine of what it calls the doctrine of necessity. And so this really should be seen as a historic moment on this aspect. But, and we can talk about this, you know, it brings us back to the political crisis that Pakistan faces and the fact that tomorrow, if Khan is voted out through the vote of no confidence, that will end Pakistan's two-time streak of civilian governments completing their five-year terms in office. And no prime minister till this point has ever completed a five-year term in office, but two civilian governments have, the one elected in 2008 and the one elected in 2013. And with this government ending, or with Khan's government ending, that will end. And the other thing I'll note is that the opposition, you know, is not going to be just being in power is not going to just be a positive development necessarily for Pakistan, because it includes an Islamist right-wing politician, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, whose politics is quite frankly deplorable. And the opposition hasn't really put forward a plan of what they want to do in their time in office. So while they will have accomplished what they wanted, Khan's ouster from power, they, you know, whether it's going to be a better alternative to Khan's 3.5 years of rule is unclear.
Dia, that's excellent framing, and I'm very grateful for it. Very clear. I'm going to come back to you in a minute, and I do want to sort of press the point as to gauging whether you see this as a moment more of opportunity than peril, but obviously it could be both. You make the excellent point that this would break Pakistan's recent impressive streak of having civilian governments complete their terms. On the other hand, it would happen as a result of the arguably proper functioning of checks and balances within civilian institutions, which would itself be impressive, at least to my amateur eye watching this politics. But before we get back to you on those questions and others, and also audience questions, which you can submit through Twitter direct message to the Brookings Institution, Brookings INST, and you'll find that on your Twitter search. Let me go, please, to Fahd and ask just for your overall take on the situation today. And how does it feel in Pakistan? Are people excited? Are they nervous? Are they hopeful? Just what's the mood of the street? Over to you, please, my friend.
And Fahd, remember to unmute yourself before you start talking.
Okay, is this better?
Yes, can hear you. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. There's clearly a lot happening here in Islamabad. Yesterday was a very big and a very significant day in terms of the Supreme Court judgment, because before that, frankly, there was a pall of depression here because, you know, of the blatant way that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan had violated the constitution. It was seen as a brazen attempt to just bypass the basic requirements of the constitution and essentially try and get away with what was just absolutely overturning the document that runs the running of the state in so many words. So the last couple of days there was a lot of confusion, ambiguity, and fear that we were sliding into a very dangerous phase in our politics. But yesterday's decision not only turned this confusion into clarity, but it also, I think, very emphatically made it clear that any deviation from the constitution was absolutely not permitted. So while it was a victory for the rule of law in Pakistan, I think it was a big rebuke to Prime Minister Imran Khan. And therefore now the vote of confidence, no confidence, is supposed to take place tomorrow morning. I don't think there should be any more confusion, because I think the order that the Supreme Court gave was very explicit in its instructions that the vote had to happen. And it is clear that the Prime Minister does not command the majority. So I think tomorrow he would be voted out and the new government will come in. Now, obviously, there are two major challenges that now face Pakistan in the next couple of days. Number one, of course, the reaction from Prime Minister Imran Khan, who's currently today the Prime Minister, and his party. What do they do? Do they accept this? Do they hit the streets, etc., etc.? And of course, the second is, what does the new incoming government do? both in terms of dealing with Mr. Khan and his politics and also running the country at a time where clearly the situation is very, very difficult. So while, you know, there is good news that Pakistan has reverted back to constitutional procedures, I think there is a lot that could possibly go wrong in the coming days and weeks.
So it sounds like, thank you very much for that. It sounds like you are both essentially saying in implicit response to my earlier question that it's both a moment of opportunity and a moment of peril. But Madia, could I come back to you and just ask you to come down sort of as sharply as you can and wish to on that question. Do you find this a promising moment or do you find this perilous? I know it's, again, both, but just I'm still trying to make sense of it all and would love your take.
Absolutely. I think in terms of the Supreme Court's judgment, that specific judgment, I think, is certainly a promising moment. You know, the Constitution prevailing is not something Pakistan has ever been able to take for granted. And that very basic notion is promising. Now, when it comes to the politics that brought Pakistan into this political crisis, that's where there's something troubling. While the no confidence move is a constitutional move, you know, and Khan, you know, as he's expected to be ousted from power tomorrow through this constitutional move, that while it's a constitutional move, it is something that only took traction, that only became something viable when Khan lost the support of the Pakistani military. So behind the scenes of all of this, behind the scenes of the opposition gaining the traction to oust Khan, behind the scenes of them gaining steam for this no confidence vote to be effective, is the fact that Imran Khan lost the support of Pakistan's military, the so-called establishment. And there are a number of reasons for doing that. And we can get into those. And that in itself is part of a much longer cycle of political instability in Pakistan caused by the ruling party, the prime minister currently in power, losing favor with the military and then being ousted from power. It has usually been done through coups or dissolution of the assembly, not through constitutional moves like a no confidence move. So while there is some, you know, semblance of procedural democracy here, in the end, one has to wonder, you know, who's really calling the shots, right? In all of this. So I think there still is a lot of work to be done in order to solidify Pakistan's democracy. But at this moment, one can say, yes, the Constitution has been prevailing in its letter. I think the other thing I will just, you know, sort of add on to what Fahad said, you know, I expect this to be a bit of a problematic moment going forward in terms of, you know, how Khan's party reacts in the coming days. I expect Khan and his party to double down on this foreign conspiracy narrative, even though there is no evidence for it whatsoever. They have not shown signs of backing off from it. And I think the Supreme Court judgment is a rebuke of that foreign conspiracy narrative. But Khan's supporters and his party are framing the Supreme Court judgment as partisan, which really just tells you how polarized the country has become. So it's going to be, sort of a moment that will be quite a defining moment when one thinks about the next election coming around, sort of how much polarization takes place, how much, partisanship comes about. You know, I think of this a little bit like the post January 6, 2021 moment in the US. And I worry that's what it's coming down to in Pakistan.
Madia, that's great. And Fahd, if I could go back to you and please help me understand this notion that it's sometimes reported in the American press that somehow Prime Minister Khan lost his close tie with the military because the military thought he was too anti-American, which I had to say I found a little confusing, because obviously Pakistan's military has had historical ties to the U.S. military, but there's also been 20 years of disagreement over Afghanistan. And in my dealings with Pakistani military over the years, while at an individual level, people tend to be very respectful and courteous, I don't sense a lot of pro-Americanism writ large throughout the ranks or the officer corps of the Pakistani military. So in what way, why would the Pakistani military get angry with Prime Minister Khan just because he said a few nasty things about the United States? Over to you.
Thank you. Well, I think this fracture in the relationship that Madhya was talking about, I think, like, you know, everything else, it's a mixture of a number of factors. I don't think it was one issue or one factor or one reason. And I think it was building up over the years. This relationship was very, very close in the early days. In fact, you know, the military played a very important role in getting Prime Minister Imran Khan into power. But even from the early days, and I'm talking, let's say, around 2019, there were differences which had begun to emerge on a number of issues. Because the establishment was so invested in the success of this government, there were many things that they had started to take exception to. For example, you know, the choice of leadership in Punjab, which is the largest province, and, you know, in many ways determines the electoral outcomes. The military, the establishment was very unhappy with the choice and the way that that province was being governed. And, you know, they made it clear to the Prime Minister a number of times that, you know, he was bleeding his political capital by appointing the wrong kind of people in such a crucial place. However, Mr. Khan was adamant and he repeatedly said, both privately and publicly, that he would not listen to what he was being told, that he would continue with his choice. So that friction began to then just get aggravated over the years. Then a number of other issues also pitched in. For example, there were some subtle differences of opinions in terms of approach to policy towards India, policy towards the United States, a number of other foreign policy regional issues where we began to see some differences in the way that the strategic outlook was being shaped. And then the lack of progress in governance, I think that also began to add to the troubles. Because after 2 or 3 years, it became clear that Prime Minister Imran Khan couldn't really deliver on in terms of governance. And the handling of the country was pretty, not just average, but below average. And I think that also began to open up a new fracture within the relationship. But I think, finally, I think the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back was this controversy over the appointment of the intelligence chief, which is normally, a routine matter. But Mr. Khan put his foot down and wanted somebody of his liking. And that, I think, just blew up because normally the establishment, the military, guards its own turf very jealously. And from there onwards, it's been a slow slide, which now has resulted in finally Mr. Khan's ouster. I think one important point, I don't think the military had any active role in making the political move against Mr. Khan successful. All they did was that they kind of stepped back from actively supporting him and propping up his government. And this act of stepping back essentially provided the opposition the political space to come in and bring down his government through what is a constitutional process.
That's very helpful. And before I go to the audience questions that we've received, I'd like to probe a little further on just two things. One is there anything at all to this charge? I know it's false, but is there still any kind of plausibility to at least part of it that the opposition is somehow in cahoots with the United States? And it looks to me as if the Prime Minister is trying to associate an opposition that he's competing with an unpopular foreign power. But creating sort of this, conspiracy theory out of whole cloth. But I wonder if there is any sort of kernel of reality to some of it that he's able to then twist and distort in his own way. That's one specific question. But a broader question, and this is perhaps especially for those who don't follow Pakistan closely or live there, how has the Prime Minister done over his four-year tenure so far, beyond the issues that, Fahd, you just so eloquently summarized, you know, with the governance in Punjab and elsewhere? But how's Pakistan done overall? And We all know some of the statistics. You know, it's been the period of COVID, and it's not been an easy period for any government on earth. And so I know not every trend line has been favorable, but just I'd be curious, how would you both assess his tenure in office? So those two questions, one, this charge of conspiracy that Han has leveled against the opposition, supposedly conniving with the United States. But then secondly, just take a step back and ask, how well has he done as prime minister over his tenure? And maybe I could start with you, Medea, please.
Sure. So the charge of foreign conspiracy, Han is relying on what he calls a threat letter, in quotes, which really is a diplomatic cable from the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. Telling the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, informing the Ministry of Foreign Affairs about a meeting he had with the Assistant Secretary of State. The meeting, some have said has, there was some undiplomatic language used in the meeting, but that's the extent of what's come out. No one has actually seen the letter, and we have, the public certainly has not seen a copy of the letter. Those who have seen the copy of the letter have not, shared it word for word. And I think Han benefits from the ambiguity that comes from people not having seen, and the public in particular not having seen the letter, because then he can argue that this letter essentially is evidence of the foreign conspiracy. But that's all he has is a letter, which is really a diplomatic cable. And, from a cabinet meeting that was held today that Han called yesterday, once, he was sort of reinstated as prime minister, a cabinet meeting said that there was going to be an inquiry that was going to begin on this foreign conspiracy charge. And I don't really expect anything to come of it. What will happen, though, is that it will sort of it will have hamstrung the opposition when it comes into power from developing a better relationship with the United States, because Khan's party and his supporters can basically say, look, you were in cahoots with the U.S. all along, and you've developed a better relationship with them, and they just wanted Khan out. And so he has not set an easy path in many ways for the opposition to develop a good relationship with the U.S. I'll just mention a couple of things on Khan's time in office. I think, one thing that I've written about over the years is that Pakistan's civilian governments always spend their time in power with this sort of threat of political instability, with the opposition being out to oust them. They spend their time in power sort of putting out political fires, if you will, rather than engaging in governance kind of reform and meaningful institutional change that the country so desperately needs. Han was in the opposition out for his predecessor's ouster, in 2014, a year after he was elected. The Pakistan Democratic Movement, this alliance of parties that now has succeeded in, or will succeed in, this no confidence vote against Khan, has been, was formed 2 years after Khan came into office. So it's a very unstable environment for a government to actually do anything. That being said, there are so no meaningful institutional change has taken place. Khan's populist platform was really one of making sure that there's no corruption, but also trying to an Islamic kind of welfare state, Pakistan become an Islamic welfare state. And there are some moves that they, the government made in that regard, including healthcare, the provision of healthcare starting in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and then spreading to other provinces, that was free. That is a plus for Pakistan. I think the government did a good job handling the coronavirus pandemic, sort of engaging in this smart lockdown policy, not a blanket lockdown, but smart lockdown policy early on that many decried, but that has ended up being effective. And Pakistan has not had the death toll that other countries, you know, with its population size have had, and, you know, certainly nothing close to what India just next door has had. But the economy is in a state of crisis right now. So, you know, the big sort of, you know, indicators are all sort of trending downwards and tanking. You know, inflation is at record levels. The rupee has fallen drastically with respect to the dollar. And people are really, really hurting economically. And that is what the opposition has seized upon as, you know, evidence of the failure of Khan's government. I'll just say one more thing. You know, Khan has this sort of antagonistic kind of brand of politics. And that is, I think, what ultimately did him in, unable to sort of keep coalition allies on board, unable to keep even his own party lawmakers on board, certainly unable to, and not wanting to mend fences with the opposition. In fact, it's existential for him, you know, sort of, you know, painting the opposition as bad as and himself as good. And ultimately, you know, not being able to sort of build any sort of political consensus is what did him in.
That's really good. Thank you. And Fahd, if I could just go to you with the same question, you know, any additional thoughts you would like to offer about the tenure of Prime Minister Khan and also whether he has the potential for a comeback after his expected unseating tomorrow. But then on top of that, if you do want to weigh in at all on this other question, whether there's anything whatsoever in your mind to the conspiracy charge, and is it gaining any traction at all within Pakistan? Over to you, my friend.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think Madhya has covered quite a bit of you know, area in terms of these questions. But I think let me just tackle the U.S. Cable letter first. I think it's become a big issue because it's been manufactured into one. It is not an organic issue. It has been deliberately brought up and then you know, presented as an exaggeration of what it probably is in reality. And you know, it is very clear that that issue has been made so big purely because of political reasons. It is correct that nobody's actually seen that letter because, you know, it is an official document and it can't be made public as yet. But from all sources that we've checked independently from within the government, from within the establishment, all indications are that it is just a normal diplomatic cable sent by the ambassador to the U.S. Detailing his meeting with a U.S. official and probably includes a bit of his analysis. So I think it is essentially the kind of document that every ambassador in every capital sends to his headquarters. Perhaps the meeting was a little bit more aggressive than it should have been, but I don't think there is anything to suggest that, you know, there is a conspiracy for a regime change. We've checked with people within the state also, people who've investigated, you know, sources have spoken to me personally also, and they've said that we've done whatever due diligence was required. And we have come up with no evidence, absolutely no evidence that there was anything, any major threat or conspiracy or even a hint of any act which would suggest regime change, which is essentially what the PTI government of Mr. Imran Khan is saying. So that much is clear. Now, the big issue is what happens now? Clearly, Mr. Khan is bent upon, you know, flogging this issue for electoral gains. Today is his last day in office. As Madhya very correctly said, that he's made a commission to investigate it. He's supposed to have an address to the nation later in the evening. It is expected that he's going to speak more on this. If that commission is made, which is made today, the new government will come in, and as Madhya said, that yes, it will be a challenge. But from what I have been told, I've spoken to some people who are now going to be forming this new incoming government, and they also say that it is in their interest to get to the bottom of it, because if this issue is left hanging, then it would become, you know, fodder for campaign politics and speeches. And that's the last thing they want. So I think, regardless of the fact that Mr. Khan will not be the prime minister tomorrow, the new incoming government will somehow or the other try and get to the bottom of it and prove once and for all that there is actually no big conspiracy and this was just merely a political issue. So I think that is to be expected in the coming days. I think overall the governance left a lot to be desired. The biggest problem with the PTI government and Mr. Khan was not just the delivery of his governance, but the level of expectation that he had raised before coming into power, and the huge gap between what he promised and what he ultimately ended up delivering. That gap was, there's always a certain gap. We all know that. But his gap was so huge that in itself has made a narrative that this government just didn't know how to govern. And that is an issue, the issue of incompetence and the issue of speaking more and doing less. That narrative is now sort of cemented in terms of the perceptions about this government. Based on that, does he have a political future? You never say never in any political scene, but it will be a difficult thing because the fundamental advantages that Mr. Khan had when he came into power, almost all of them are gone. What were those advantages? Number one, he was untested. Now he's tested. Number two, he had a big talk. That talk has been tested now and found wanting. Number three, he had the full support of the military. That is not there anymore. And number four, he came in saying that he's going to fix the economy and fix the whole system of governance in a major strategic way. He hasn't been able to do that. So all of these advantages that propelled him to power are now evaporated. It would make the thing so much more difficult for him to make a comeback in the short run.
Wonderful answers. Thank you both. I've got one final question as we look to wrap up here in about 5 or 7 minutes. And I'm going to take a couple of audience questions and blend them into this overarching question. And it really sort of boils down to, what do you see as the proper priorities for an expected new prime ministership tomorrow, Shahbaz Sharif most likely? And what should he be trying to accomplish in the next 12 months? And then if able and empowered to go beyond that time, about Pakistan's future more generally. And this is, of course, in the context, and this is where I'll bring in some of the specific audience questions. You can touch on these if you wish in answering that or not. But in the context of the ongoing war in Ukraine, the contentious visit to Moscow by the existing prime minister, the incumbent, just as the war was beginning, the complicated triangular diplomacy with India, China, and Russia that Pakistan is attempting to manage. And of course, this in the context of a country of well over 200 million people with a nuclear arsenal that some worry could potentially be, at some jeopardy depending on how future political stability is maintained or not. And so what's the real goal and priority for the new government that we expect to see formed here very shortly in Pakistan? If I could start, please, with Medea, and then we'll go to Fahd as we wrap up. Thank you.
Well, the new government, has a couple of advantages and a couple of disadvantages as it starts out. One is that it's only probably going to be in power for a little less than a year before fresh elections are going to be due next summer. They were held in July of 2018, so they should be held in the summer of 2023. And a caretaker setup needs to set up for the next elections 3 months prior to those elections. So there's only about a year left in this kind of National Assembly term, the government will be saddled with all the economic problems of Khan's government, right, and of this time. And so while it has kind of the political runway in order to set things up to be elected the next time around, one thing I should mention is that Khan dissolving the National Assembly on Sunday, or trying to and failing, was about who he wants to be in power before the next election, because there's a belief in Pakistan that whoever is in power prior to the election can set things up to their advantage and to their benefit, especially when it comes to Punjab and sort of doling out favors in terms of sort of the patronage politics that exists in Punjab. And so if, you know, Shehbaz Sharif is in power in the federal government and his son Hamza Shehbaz is in power in Punjab, then essentially what that means is that there is sort of there can be a little bit of a tilt that the government can put in their favor in order to win in the next election. And that's something they, I'm sure that they will be attempting to do, because, you know, the goal for the opposition is not just to be in power for a year, but to come into power for that next term starting in 2023. The disadvantage, as I sort of alluded to, is the fact that they will have to, you know, set things right, figure out what to do with inflation, figure out what to do with the dollar, figure out, you know, what to do with sort of these rising food and gas prices that have people so worried. And that's sort of the major crisis. And they haven't really put forward a plan. You know, their sort of goal has been the ouster of Khan's government, but the alternative plan is not something that has been shared, at least with the public. And so, you know, we'll be looking to see what that is from here, of course, as well. What that this government can do is a couple of things. I'll just mention a little bit on sort of foreign relations and a little bit on dealing with rising terrorism in the country. So I think one thing that doesn't get mentioned, that may have caused a bit of a rift in recent months between Khan and the military, you know, and this is sort of implicit, is the fact that Khan has been in favor of talks with the Pakistani Taliban, a resurgent Pakistani Taliban that has been attacking Pakistan security forces. The military has been more at this point, because they are the ones getting attacked, though not historically always in Pakistan's history have they been against the Pakistani Taliban, but at this point, under attack from the Pakistani Taliban, they're more sort of in favor of operations against the Pakistani Taliban. And, you know, one thing that the Shehbaz Sharif government, when it comes into power, can do is basically launch and, you know, with the military, an operation against the Pakistani Taliban to sort of rout it out, because it's clear that peace talks with them have not been effective. So that's one. The second thing is, you know, sort of righting sort of the some of the mistakes that have been made in foreign on the foreign policy front in recent weeks. I think, you know, at the civilian government, Khan's government, and the military were on the same page until sometime last year when it came to foreign policy, saying, you know, Pakistan wanted good relationships with all major powers, with Russia, China, the US. You know, it wanted to focus on geoeconomics you know, sort of really focus on regional connectivity. The events, you know, especially of recent weeks and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, made that a very difficult line to walk on. And Khan sort of walked on, you know, what was not the sort of the right line on that, in terms of ending up in Moscow that day. It was a coincidental visit, but in terms of the optics, it looked like Pakistan was embracing Russia. And he didn't do enough in some ways to walk that back. You know, the neutrality, while Pakistan has remained studiously neutral since then, the optics of Khan being in Russia the day Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine were terrible for him. And I think there was not enough done by his government to walk that back. The chief of army staff tried to walk some of that back in a speech a couple of days ago, last Saturday, actually, where he explicitly called it Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Khan hasn't, and said, you know, it cannot be condoned, and used pretty strong language. So, you know, Pakistan can sort of still walk this line, can still abstain, you know, from UN General Assembly votes and so on, while being a little bit more prudent in its language, you know, that is something this new government will likely do in sort of in concert, I think, with the military in the coming weeks and months. I think, you know, it'll be more of a balancing act then with the US and with China, rather than what has ended up looking, with Khan not being called by Biden, like Pakistan's embrace of Russia and China at the expense of the US. I think Pakistan will revert to more of the balancing act that perhaps the military wants and sort of the foreign policy establishment really wants.
Madia, thank you. And so Fahd, as I go to you, if I could just summarize, it sounds like Madia is saying that in the foreign policy domain, there's sort of a natural path that is likely to be somewhat successful in just stabilizing Pakistan's relations with a number of other countries and undoing some of the recent missteps, especially in regards to Russia over the Ukraine crisis, but more generally. On the other hand, on the economic front, I would think the challenges are much more profound and less easily solved. And maybe, as you talked about, the competence or lack thereof of the Han government, a little more competence would be welcome in a new government, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, but please correct me. But it's still the structural problems, the COVID issues and other things are so profound that it would seem the path forward on the economic front is going to be more difficult. Do I have it right?
Well, yes, actually, that's pretty accurate, I think. A couple of key priorities that I think we are expected to see from the new government. There is going to be a combination of some substantive work and some optics, because remember, this is, as Madia said, that you know, we maximum we're about a year away from elections. They could even take place earlier. In fact, one of the key decisions that the new government will have to take once they are sworn into office is when to opt for elections. That is a major issue that has to be decided. There are two different schools of thought which one is hearing. One is that some people are saying that, you know, the sooner we go to elections, the better it is, because the situation of the country is so bad that the
I fear we've just lost Fahd for the moment. Fahd, I don't know if you're able to hear me. And so maybe Rahman, my colleague at Brookings, you could come on and clarify which one of us has lost connectivity.
Yes. I think Fahd just lost connectivity. I think we were planning on wrapping up now anyway. So if
yes,
we can just wrap.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I will just thank everyone, especially Fahd and Madia, but certainly everyone else. And I want to wish friends in Pakistan the very, very best going forward. You're an important country and clearly a crucial moment.